Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This hour, we're going to tick off some of the big, amazing, confounding things that happened this week and figure out what it means, what's important about it to you. And my guests are Joni Balter from Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail and the former mayor of the town of Seattle, Washington, Mike McGinn, and the former attorney general of the state of formerly Washington Territory, eventually becoming a state, Rob McKenna. Hello, everybody.
Hello, everybody.
In a historical mindset today, Bill.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the big picture here. We would like to hear from you here in this northern hemisphere. You can talk with us during the show on Twitter using the hashtag KUOWWIR. That's Week in Review. Comment at our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. You can send us an email. I'm getting really historical here. You can send us an email at weekinreview@kuow.org. Should we get at it?
Yes.
Okay. Topic number one. Is it okay for your member of Congress to avoid his constituents? Members of Congress are on recess, home in their districts, meeting with their constituents, but 8th District Republican Dave Reichert decided not to hold a public town hall meeting. Reichert said these days a town hall can turn into an unproductive shouting match, as some recent town halls have for Republican Congress members. Reichert told King 5 he's not scared of getting yelled at.
I was a cop for 33 years. I've been shot at, stabbed. I was in the middle of WTO, as you know. I don't think anybody would believe that I would be afraid to meet with anybody, anywhere, anytime, as long as it's respectful discourse.
He's not scared personally, but he says he feared for the safety of his staff and constituents. So instead of a town hall, Reichert went on Facebook Live and answered pre-submitted questions. That is not okay with 8th District resident Marty Rhodes, who was one of hundreds of people who turned out near Congressman Reichert's office in Issaquah.
I'm here because Representative Reichert refuses to meet with us face-to-face, and in this day and age of contentious politics, I think it's important for us to look each other eye-to-eye. And we're really not wanting to fight with him. We're wanting to have a conversation.
Did Congressman Reichert do the right thing ethically, politically, former Mayor McGinn?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, just show up. When I was mayor, I did town halls. It felt like every couple of weeks, come one, come all.
Did you get shouted down?
People yelled at me. Yeah, I did get shouted down one time. But you know what? If you show up and you keep showing up, sooner or later, you get to the dialogue part, was my experience. Hmm. But if you never show up, then it can really spiral out of control.
So it's not fair to act like a shouting match must be unproductive, that you just keep going?
You have to remember who's the boss and who's working for who. Uh-huh. And elected officials work for the public. And would you ever say to your boss, hey, sorry, I can't talk to you. You might yell at me. No, you go in and you talk to the boss. And if you don't like your boss, then get out of the job.
Rob McKenna, did you ever duck a public meeting?
No, I held regular town hall meetings when I was on the county council, and in the statewide office, you don't tend to do that. I had other kinds of public meetings. I think I understand what Congressman Reichert's getting at here, though. He pointed out, and I haven't independently verified this, but he pointed out that Senator Murray, Senator Cantwell don't hold town hall meetings either in person. That would be worth double checking if that's true. Mm-hmm. I think it's because they all find these meetings aren't that productive, in the sense that they're staged, that there's, you know, it's orchestrated, and it gets away from the idea or ideal of a town hall meeting, of actual dialogue with interested citizens who come in, who are there not because someone has called them up and sent them, but because they're there. Now, the problem
is that
with
that fair, though?
No, well, that's the problem with the argument, is that clearly there are people who are motivated to go to the town hall meetings who are upset about, you know, the potential repeal of Obamacare. So I think that's a great overgeneralization. At the same time, you know, this is happening across the country, and it isn't the first time. This isn't the first year that congressmen have moved away from this live town hall format.
So let's go back to that and review how that went years ago when people decided to avoid talking to the people who elected them. It didn't go well.
Are we talking about the Tea Party years?
We're talking about 2009 health care right here in Washington. I just wanted to say before I got rolling here, humble enemy of the American people reporting for duty here this afternoon. So let's go back to that. What happened? So do you remember then Representative Brian Baird said that he thought that these town halls about health care were like lynch mobs, and he wouldn't do it for a while until he had to apologize and then schedule 5 more meetings because people were so mad at him for not meeting with them. They elected him. Come see me. Come talk to me. Representative Rick Larson at the time went to Aqua Sox Stadium and faced thousands of people who thought
in Everett
who thought there were death panels, that Obamacare meant death panels. That was the summer of that time. He stood there. I remember just being sort of like out of breath watching this. He stood there. He talked to them. Yes, it was heated. It must have been a little scary from his side of things. But he met with them. I just don't think there's a good argument for not facing doing the eye contact, as one of the clips I heard.
Doing eye contact.
With people who elected you. It just makes you look like a wimp. I mean, I don't know what else you look like.
I have a fair bit of admiration for these guys that are going and are standing up. And, you know, they say their lines and sometimes they get clobbered. But that's actually good for them to hear. If that line's not working, then maybe you need to examine what line you're using. I mean, politics works on an emotional level as well, and it is important to let people share how they feel with you. And I'm just going back to my own personal experience. It made me a better mayor. I felt like I did a better job when I heard people's emotions as well as their arguments, and it made me stop and think about what I was doing and why. It made a difference. And not every conversation is, you know, an erudite long one, but they're good ones and they're important ones. And if you keep showing up, people respect that even if they don't agree with you.
Rob McKenna, you sound the closest to being okay with Dave Reichert skipping town halls this recess.
Well, sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander. I mean, this, you know, it's not just Republican members of Congress who are skipping them this year. As you know, Reichert claims that our senators don't hold live town hall meetings either.
How do you feel about that?
I think there's value in live town hall meetings, but I think it's left to the judgment of the elected official. There are lots of other ways to have contact in real time, face to face with your constituents. Our senators, our members of Congress all hold thousands of meetings a year, per person with their constituents, whether that's here when they're holding office hours or back in D.C. In fact, it's pretty common if you go in to have a meeting with someone, a member of Congress, you're only given 10 minutes, 15 minutes, no more than 20, because they're cramming as many of these meetings in with constituents as possible. So the absence of a town hall meeting doesn't mean they don't have face-to-face contact. They really do.
And sometimes those constituents meet with staff, so they're not exactly meeting with you, and you're not hearing what concern they have. You know, there were some better examples, as the mayor suggested here, of folks who went in and listened. Tom Cotton, senator from Arkansas, was down there.
Republican.
He went in. Folks were saying, hi, I'm not a paid protester. I want you to hear my concern about me or someone else losing health care. I mean, it's different if you hear it from folks, what you're doing in Washington, D.C. is impacting people's lives.
Rob McKenna, if a constituent of Dave Reichert's comes to his office in Issaquah and chants, "Hey, Dave, where are you?" or that kind of thing. Are they being liberals shouting down Republicans? And is that fair game to show up and say, "Hey,
absolutely,
you know,
it is.
Do your job."
And again, turnabout is fair play. Which is to say, in 2009, folks were upset about the adoption of Obamacare, came out and did the same kinds of things. They yelled, they were angry. There was a mixture of organized activists and people who just showed up on their own. And now we're seeing the reverse happen as well. So absolutely, they should show up and argue, and groups of them should be allowed to meet with the congressman and his staff. If they can't get everyone in, have representatives come in and share those views.
Finally, does Congressman Dave Reichert pay a political price for skipping the town hall meeting or not?
I think so.
Is that wise, politically wise?
Yeah, I think he will pay a price. We'll find out. You know, there's a lot of things that happen between today and his reelection campaign. But
when is that?
2 years. But people,
or sometimes they start right about now, depending on if you have a real challenge.
Yeah.
But he doesn't seem to have
yeah.
one. Right.
So it's a lot of time between now and then. But this is a type, look, we're all talking about it. This is the type of thing that penetrates the public consciousness. And when was the last time Dave Reichert was in the news? So this is not a great story for him, and he's going to have some work to do to rebuild his relationship with constituents if he's telling them, I'm scared to meet with you. I know he says he's not scared, but anytime a politician starts a sentence with, I am not, he's usually not in a good place.
I don't think
it's the McGinn rule.
I am not a crook. I am not scared. These are not good things for politicians to say, because that's what we're talking about now. Is he scared of his own constituents? That's not a good place for Dave Reichert to be.
I don't really think he pays as much as you think because of the redrawing of the district, the 8th district. At one time, it was kind of a competitive district, or seemed to be. He would face really strong challengers, Dave Reichert, every cycle. But now...
You're saying former sportscaster Tony Ventrella is not a strong...
I am saying that because of the way he conducted the campaign. He didn't campaign, he didn't raise money, and that's not a campaign. But the 8th district has been redrawn, and it stretches across the Cascades, and it's a bit safer for him. He won by 60.2% or something like that, so he's not sweating that.
Yeah, I doubt he pays much of a penalty either, but as you say, Mike, there's a ways to go until 2018.
Indeed. KUOW has invited Congressman Reichert to come on our air and talk about this, and his staff said he was busy and couldn't work it out, and we have a standing invitation to Congressman Reichert. We'd love to talk to him. And we'd love to talk to you some more about what happened this week. Is legal pot going to be illegal again in Washington? Taxes on property again? Taxes on soda? That's been tried before. Slowing down or speeding up the game of baseball, and more coming up. KUOW's Week in Review, talking about the big news of the week and why it's important. Joni Balter, Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail, former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, former State Attorney General Rob McKenna, and I'm Bill Radke. We'd like to hear from you on Twitter. The hashtag is at KUOWWIR for Week in Review. Our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. Our email address, weekinreview@kuow.org. Will Washington State's legal marijuana become illegal again? Sort of already was. It's really extraordinary here. The White House spokesman Sean Spicer says this week that he expects states to be subject to greater enforcement of federal laws against marijuana use. Spicer said President Trump is okay with medical marijuana, especially for people who are terminally ill.
There's a big difference between that and recreational marijuana. And I think that when you see something like the opioid addiction crisis, blossoming in so many states around this country, the last thing that we should be doing is encouraging people. There is still a federal law that we need to abide by.
Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson said he's deeply disappointed to hear this, and that his office will, quote, use every tool at our disposal to ensure that the federal government does not undermine Washington's successful unified system for regulating recreational and medical marijuana. That's the current Attorney General. The man who used to hold the job is right here, Rob McKenna. Is Washington State about to lose legal pot?
Well, pot is not legal in this state under federal law.
Uh-huh.
It's legal under state law. So we've had this problem from the beginning.
Right.
And frankly, it's a problem which existed with medical marijuana as well. It's just that, once again, the federal government chose not to enforce its own laws prohibiting it against the states. They decided it was a very low priority. And that concept of low priority for enforcement was expanded in the Cole Memorandum by DOJ under Eric Holder to cover recreational marijuana. The problem has only become more complicated, of course, because now you have seven states plus the District of Columbia which have legalized recreational marijuana, and a much larger number, of course, that have now legalized medical marijuana. So this creates a real conundrum for the federal government. In fact, I can't think of another example in my lifetime of such an open conflict between federal and state law.
Right. Do you have any prediction?
I doubt they're going to move forward personally, because it would create tremendous resource problems for the US DOJ. I mean, where do they start, for one thing? But then again, Jeff Sessions is a very conservative attorney general, and he's been one of the most aggressive anti-drug senators. So I guess we have to watch and see.
Mike McGinn, you'd be in the position of being in a city, in a state that's legalized something federally illegal. How do you think this would work if it happened? Would federal agents plow under pot fields or close down pot shops? I mean, what would state officials do in response? I can't imagine.
Well, this is crazy. And Rob is right about the conflict between federal and state law. So you start getting to the point of who enforces the law. And that's a big problem, because in the city of Seattle, we made marijuana enforcement the lowest enforcement priority even before state law made it legal. Mm-hmm. And so is the federal government going to send out people to arrest people for smoking pot?
No, but here's what they will do. This is what I predict. If the DOJ and the White House decides to go down this road, what they'll do is target the retailers. They'll go out, they'll seize assets. They'll shut them down. They might make arrests as well, but the fastest way they could do real damage would be financially more than putting
people
in
jail. Right, and they'll go at the retailers, they'll go at the growers, they'll grow at, go at the ability to bank, they'll do all sorts of things to mess with it. And the problem with that is we are now pushing all of these people back into a prohibition era type of non-regulation. And that is what drives crime. That's what's going to drive problems, not what legality has done. Just as with ending prohibition, you know, Al Capone was, you know, running alcohol and guns with it and other things. Bringing all of this stuff into legality and regulating it is the right public safety response, not pushing it back into the shadows again. And this is going to be really bad.
So what's curious about this, among many other things, is that during the campaign, the primary campaign, Donald Trump was not viewed as one of the candidates who was going to go after recreational pot in the states. He said, let the states work on this, which is what was happening anyway. The people who folks in the pot world were worried about were Chris Christie and Marco Rubio were the two who were supposed to be the ones, oh boy, look at, if you're one of those states legalizing recreational marijuana, you're the ones we're coming after. So now pot is legal for 68 million people to go after. It's 8 states and the District of Columbia. It's the entire West Coast when Canada joins. I mean, this is going to be a really weird rollout if there is what you guys are suggesting, the way that they would enforce it. I mean, and think about this as well. There's a great irony right now. Our state and many of the other states are getting kind of addicted, if that's the right word, to the pot tax revenues. So you've heard in Olympia already Republicans, ironically, saying that some of the tax revenues they would like to dedicate to McCleary education funds are the pot tax revenues, which are estimated, I think, this year or next to be about $270 million. So that's real money. And the irony is that you have the Republicans, you know, sort of doing unnatural yoga moves here to kind of make it all happen for them. So they would be starting a big fight over something that's, I don't think, is going to go well. And the opioid argument also, you know, shouldn't we be using the law enforcement we have for something more serious like the opioid matter rather than pot? People just sitting there smoking a little pot?
Now, here's the best argument for the government going in this direction. It's that it might finally force Congress to do something, because Congress has been able to get away with not acting on the lack of congruency between federal and state law in this area. And if the federal government moved aggressively to shut down recreational pot by going after the retailers, by going after the growers in particular, you know, maybe at that point, you know, 68 million people, if there are that many who care that strongly about it, would call on Congress to take some action. So you might need this in order for Congress to actually move. Right now, we're in this, just to give the conservative point of view, one of the reasons for the interest in doing this is the high level of discomfort with just selectively enforcing laws, or selectively deciding which laws we will not enforce.
Oh, it says you could be talking about immigration right now.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Right? Because in a sense, it's not, this isn't just about Donald Trump. We have, you know, when it comes to immigration, he would be enforcing a law that President Obama, more than President Obama, was enforcing it. But if you want different laws, you could say, well, talk to Congress.
Attorney General Sessions could say, look, our job is to enforce the law. I am not going to pick and choose which laws I enforce. If it's on the books, we're going to enforce it. And that might do more than anything to push Congress to take some action.
I just want to say, I think that a lot of Trump voters are not going to be happy about coming to take the dope away, because let's face it, marijuana is not a left-right issue. As much as people, you know, want to push it into a law and order category, it's a cultural thing. And Americans overwhelmingly, you know, nationwide, accept legalization as the right way to go. And that's going to include a lot of those rural white voters that Trump supposedly is wrapping
up
his majorities
in. Idea of, it cuts,
is,
and
there's going to be a backlash.
The enforcement cuts against the idea that the federal government should have less of a role. We should leave things to the states. Contrasts have been drawn to the administration's decision to leave it to the states to decide about transgender bathroom laws, for example. But yet in the same press conference, Spicer is saying, oh, but we may come after the states on marijuana.
Very yeah. consistent on that. Very.
That's right. The White House said states' rights this week about transgender, the right to use a public school bathroom or locker room that accords with your gender identity. What do you think is going to happen to transgender rights in Washington state? We are a state where, so far, you can choose to use that bathroom or locker room.
Well, we're sort of, our governor and our attorney general are sort of competing to be the anti-Trump here. So's the mayor. He's in this, too. And I think that our state is going to follow, you know, its own guidance on that. They've said that. They've said that this is going to be a place where we do what we want to do on that, basically.
But might there be a state initiative to...
Signature gathering phase last year. They did not gather enough signatures, and there was already an opposition campaign to that measure ready to go, and I assume that same campaign will rise up again.
And this gets to that question, have Washingtonians moved on on the issue, sort of become more sophisticated and enlightened about transgender rights? Or I keep hearing the word emboldened, you know, like that with President Trump in office, that conservatives feel more like they're able to say, oh, yeah, as if they were just being tolerant, because I guess that's what you have to do in America these days. But that's getting less and less the case.
Yeah. What do you think, Mike?
I think that's the beauty of places like Seattle, the more that people have experience getting to know and meet other people, it, you know, helps makes those discriminatory things go away. And transgender issues are a lot tougher. But this is the path that Washington State is taking and the path we're supposed to be on.
Yeah.
And I would predict good things in the future, but you got to go through so much pain to get there, it seems.
I agree there's not likely to be much impact on Washington State. I mean, after all, if the administration is saying leave it to the states, well, our state has decided what to do on that issue.
Yeah. Okay, so just finally, real briefly, former Attorney General, what tools? The current Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, says we'll use every tool at our disposal. This is regarding recreational marijuana. Does the state have any tools?
I don't see it, frankly. I don't think the state's in a very strong position legally. Are they going to intervene on the side of retailers and growers who are arrested or whose assets are seized by the federal government? I'm not even sure the state has standing to do that. I know the AG
Wow.
does not have standing to intervene on behalf of individuals in civil rights cases.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another one to follow.
The first tool they're using is they wrote a really nice letter saying, can we have a meeting?
Can we have a meeting? Yeah, he wrote an open letter to
Jeff Sessions. And they also haven't heard back. So.
Yeah, good luck with that. I mean, you know, I had to deal with this along with my colleague in Colorado early on, and it's hard to get the federal government to cooperate on this stuff. So I hope they get their meeting, but I'm not optimistic.
I mean, we can look at what was happening even under Obama, when the U.S. attorney, Jenny Durkan, was shutting down medical marijuana operations under, you know, because they were too close to schools or parks. And there wasn't actually a law out there that she was enforcing. She was finding some middle space between completely illegal under federal law and legal under state law and coming up with her own interpretation. And she did it. And there wasn't a whole lot that could be done to stop it from the local level.
Okay,
so that's the challenge. Is it's more in that enforcement range.
We'll see whether Bob Ferguson and Jeff Sessions sit face to face. Yes,
a lot of love there. I would
imagine. A lot of love in that room. More Seattle taxes, less Milo Yiannopoulos, and more of all of that coming up on KUOW's Week in Review. We're spending this hour with Rob McKenna, Mike McGinn, and Joni Balter talking about the big news of the week, including the return of the soda tax. This week, Seattle Mayor Ed Murray proposed a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages, a 2 cent per ounce tax on sodas, energy and sports drinks, sweetened teas, fruit drinks, but not pure fruit juice, packaged coffee drinks like those glass-bottled Frappuccino drinks, not the barista latte. And this is not a tax at the cash register. It's a tax that the drink distributors would pay. The money, an estimated $16 million a year, would mostly go toward early education programs. Former Mayor Mike McGinn, you supported a soda tax a few years ago, didn't you?
Yeah, we brought it up as an idea to help fund our parks. I was at the time, you know, had put together a committee and we were looking at renewing the property tax levy for the parks, which I supported. But we're always putting stuff on the property tax levy. Is there a better way to do it? And so, yeah, we did look at that. Absolutely.
Is this idea better or worse?
You know, I guess where I start here is, actually where I start here is, city budget spending has gone up by 25% in the last 3 years. The general fund used to be about $960 million. It's now $1.2 billion. And if you look at departments, the mayor's office itself has gone up 80%. That's $3 million a year right there. So I think one of the things is, and it kind of goes to both levies, both the sugar tax and the housing levy, if you're going to go to the voters, you need to show that you're managing your own budget. When you got $250 million more a year in the general fund and you're putting, you know—
How would he show that he—are you saying he's not shown that he's managing his budget?
Yes. There's no management of this budget. I mean, it's just
no management of this budget.
Well,
wow.
It's just exploding.
He looks pretty happy just saying that to me.
No, it's I know it's a
one
harsh
mayor
thing
to
say.
Another.
It's a harsh thing to say, but when you go for I dealt with the recession. We had to deal if we wanted to spend on one thing, we had to cut another thing.
Right,
and we did. And what we're seeing here is always going to just new taxes, and the taxes are always regressive. You know, I mean, let's look at this property.
This is Mike McGinn of the American Policy Institute.
Yeah.
Yes. So, frequently is there.
I mean, let's just take a look at the, I'm sorry, I'm jumping topics a little bit, but let's look at the homelessness levy. We're going to do a property tax levy for that. And Also just announced this week. And we're asking the big businesses if they'll voluntarily put in money. Shouldn't we flip that? Shouldn't we be taxing the big businesses and maybe not putting everything on the property tax levy?
What do you think?
I think we need to start looking at how do we manage the budget and who should pay for these things and not always be putting it on the property tax.
So I feel like I've written that column maybe several times that, you know, look, the city is flush right now. And you know that because you managed
when it wasn't
in
flush.
Leaner
yeah.
times. So the city's flush from all the stuff that you can see when you look out your window. So they have plenty of money. And they also have an affinity that does not stop for going to the voters time after time. And remember, the voters always say yes. So that's another part of this conversation. But it feels to me that the homelessness levy that was mentioned for August is in a way sort of preparing for the fact that this sanctuary city is not doing well with the Trump administration and could lose federal funds for homelessness. It's almost like
Mayor Murray has said exactly that.
Yeah, so it seems to me he's trying to get ahead of that, and he's going to a pretty trusty source, the voters. They say yes time and again.
So if the voters are happy with it, what's the problem?
Well, how many of the voters in Seattle don't own real property? First of all, it's easy to vote for a property tax. I mean, it does come to them indirectly.
But that's
rent.
A myth that the renters aren't paying. That's just because it's not itemized
they
for
don't,
them.
But they don't see it as well, Joni. I mean, I'll bet the rate of I-votes is higher among people who don't own property.
Oh, I'll bet it is, too, because it's not presented to them that it's in the bill.
Yeah.
But we're talking all costs and no benefits. I mean, Mayor Murray is saying this is... look around you. People are on the streets. He cited the toddlers under viaducts with no parents and women being sex trafficked and imminent danger.
It's the kind of argument that drove me crazy when I was budget chairman at King County. If it's an emergency, and the mayor and the county executives have declared homelessness is an emergency in Seattle and in King County, wouldn't you fund an emergency with your first dollars? Not go out and ask for new dollars. This is exactly the argument that Executive Sims and I used to have over 9/11 funding. Is there something more important that King County does than fund 911 and EMS? I don't think so. But yet
that sounds like
a
reason.
Voter approved measure. We do it. It was done that way because they figured they could get the voters to say yes.
Well,
I ask again,
if the voters. So is that the problem? Because it's a tax on property owners said yes to by people who don't own property. Is
well,
that
no,
problem?
that's not the real argument. That's not the real issue. The real issue is. If it is an emergency, if it's among the most important priorities you have, you fund it first. And then if you need, you know, this is the way it ought to be done, in my opinion. Then if you have lower priorities, they don't have enough money, then you go out and ask voters to fund those. But they always do it the other way around. It's like taking those emergency services or homelessness services hostage instead of reprioritizing and managing the budget.
Well, I'm going to go back There's a lot to that, but I'm going to go back to the initial point here, which is we have tools right now. We don't have to go to the voters to raise money for this. The city council could right now adjust the B&O tax as an example. They could exempt small businesses and raise the rate on our very, very successful big businesses, and they could raise all the money they need. They could go to another tax on businesses that the city council has authority to change right now. Instead, we're...
Why don't they?
Well, you know... They don't because they know that the voters are generous and will be very compassionate, and they will not punish the city for mismanaging the budget. They will help the homeless. But they know that if they tax the corporations, corporations aren't as generous, and they will punish the elected officials. They'll go find themselves some new elected officials to back.
But you're not recommending a no vote if this hits the August ballot, are you?
If it goes to a vote, I would vote for it because I would not punish homeless people because this mayor and council can't manage the budget or won't tax corporations.
It's a
I won't
Hobson's
punish homeless
choice,
people.
It's
but
a
that's the but that's the fact is they so, are
but
not.
But that's how we budget around here. We take the things that we know that the voters are amenable to, take them outside the budget, and then don't worry about the rest of it because you've already been backfilled there.
And the implicit threat is voters, if you don't approve it, we're gonna eliminate your 911 service. We're not gonna deal with homelessness. That's the implicit threat. I just find that extremely troubling. Always have.
It's sort of like a shadow budget, if you think of it. There's the budget that's flush right now, and then there's all these different property tax and other kinds of levies that are funding a zillion other things. So
I mean, there was if you may remember, there was $160 million North Precinct being proposed, and that was not going to be put up for a vote. As an example, that was going to be funded out of existing funds. The same thing is. You know, I mentioned the mayor's office budget just because I happen to know it. That's real money. That's gone up $3 million a year. Nobody's putting the mayor's office budget
to
a vote.
It's gone up $3 million or by $3
million? It's gone up by $3 million a year. It's gone up 80% in 3 years. So nobody has put, and the council have all, they have smaller districts and they have more staff. So their budget has gone up pretty dramatically too. Nobody puts the council's budget or the mayor's budget up for a vote. They just increase it and then they go and ask for a new homeless vote. And this is manage your budget effectively, then go to the voters, and then go in the most progressive way possible. In my opinion, that would be looking at our very successful corporations to pay more. Don't put it all on property tax and homeowners.
I get the impression that the soda tax would not go to voters, that it would go to the city council, where it would be viewed probably favorably as well. But
that'll go into effect.
With the council.
Doesn't the American Beverage Association come spend money to try to stop that from happening?
And they did it in New York City.
They did that in many other places. They did that in the legislature when they were trying to use the soda tax to help bail the state out when it was having some financial trouble.
So here's a conservative's argument in favor of a tax on sugary soda. It's really bad for you.
True.
And depends how much sugar is in the taxes. Mm. If you can get a something without sugar, it's
yes.
Okay. But the thing is that if you can drive down the consumption of the sugary beverages, you're going to have public health benefits in terms of reduced obesity, tooth decay, et cetera. We discovered this in spades with higher taxes on tobacco. The key factor in driving down teenage smoking rates was the fact we made smoking more expensive.
So you're not bothered by it being a regressive tax because it's on the right users of the right thing.
Well, it's a bad product, so it bothers me less than other taxes would. I have a different view of this than I would of increasing property taxes to fund an emergency service or to help the homeless.
Why beverages? Why not sugar? I will continue to consume Jelly Bellies unless the government steps in and gives me a disincentive to do so.
Do not worry. They're coming for you next.
I don't want to. Okay, but each one has packed so much flavor in just a very small bite.
It's easier to define. Do you remember when the legislature passed a tax on candy? Then there was a huge fight over what is candy. I remember the makers of Almond Roca got in there and they were arguing they're not candy. And there were some pretty heated meetings in the governor's office over what's candy and what's not.
Mm.
If it has flour, is it another?
Well, right. They actually had to come up with this definition. One advantage of taxing sugared soda pop is we know what it is and you can't really disguise it. While they're at it, they might want to do something about Four Loko.
Right. I think the most important thing for me for a sugar-sweetened beverage tax, and as I said, that was something we developed when we were in office but never brought it forth, is that you really want a very strong nexus to health if you're going to be taxing with a regressive tax. You want it to go back to the people who would benefit most from the spending.
Right.
And ideally,
they were dedicating it to early education.
Early education.
So it's not completely illogical.
No, it's not completely. And that was one of the reasons why we were tying it to parks and healthy recreation.
Right.
You know, as an idea, as a way to not put it all on the property tax, but to find another method. So I think that's really important here. To do that. But I do think that the bigger picture, and I hit it pretty hard, the bigger picture of if you're going to keep asking for more taxes, you got to be managing your budget and also looking for other ways to get it than putting on the people that are least able to pay.
What you have to worry about, of course, is that you start out with the money going to early childhood education from the sugary soda pop tax, and then it ends up being dumped into the general fund and isn't used for that dedicated purpose. This is exactly what we saw happen with the money from the tobacco settlement. Much to Chris Gregoire's frustration as Attorney General and Governor, the money was diverted away from tobacco use prevention and just used to help fill up the budget. And that's not to mention bonded at one point, 30% of it's bonded, and that just went in to fill a budget gap during Governor Locke's administration.
And that could well happen with the pot tax revenues because some of those are dedicated to prevention and education.
Of what? Of using pot?
No, the pot taxes are designed to the, you remember the initiative. Yeah. Part of it goes to drug prevention and education. So,
well, thank God marijuana is not a drug.
Right.
There you go. Well, there you go.
Apparently it's an opioid, according to Sean Spicer. Okay, so finally, are we unanimous? Sugar tax, soda tax passes the city council.
Does Sean Spicer know that spice is a very popular synthetic drug being consumed in cities? I just want to get that out there.
It should be taxed, I think.
And should be taxed heavily, but he might object to that. Maybe he's getting a cut.
Soda tax passes the council. Property tax passes the voters in August?
Oh, yeah.
Anybody think no? Everybody say yes?
Yep.
Yeah, manage your budget. I heard you.
Yeah, you heard
and
me.
Yay.
But the people are compassionate.
The people are compassionate.
The people of the city are compassionate. But it's
a Hobson's choice. You know, if you want to fund this, you got to vote for this tax. Otherwise, we're implicitly threatening not to take care of, not to address homelessness.
Okay, stay tuned to KOW. Or the threat is we are not going to talk about Milo Yiannopoulos or speeding up the game of baseball. Okay, and I mean it.
Okay,
stay tuned. You'll find out. Here's how you can be part of KOW's Week in Review. Our Twitter hashtag is KOWWIR. Facebook page, KOW Public Radio. Our email address, weekinreview@KOW.org. Just in case, we've also assembled some humans here. Mike McGinn, former Seattle mayor, Washington State Attorney General, was Rob McKenna, and Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail host, Joni Balter. And by the way, we're just hearing about this news that the New York Times and CNN and Politico were all shut out of a scheduled White House press briefing. So apparently Sean Spicer waved in Breitbart News, the One American News Network, Washington Times, and ABC, CBS, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, Fox News was there. Can they do that? Can they shut some media outlets out of a scheduled press briefing?
It sounds like a first-class lawsuit, which is something, and I don't know the exact basis of it because it's just happening right now, but you cannot pick and choose which press you like.
Why not?
I think it depends on what kind of meeting it was. It isn't clear from the little article we just read whether it was the regular White House briefing in the briefing room or it was a separate meeting for some press with Spicer.
Can't they just say, well, we just canceled the scheduled briefing and now we're holding an extra meeting that we're calling?
And a lot of judges will buy that, right?
Well, but I mean, they don't invite every blogger in. Why is that? Is that really a legal consideration that you have to have the New York Times in
the room? I'm struggling to think of a legal theory. At first, I thought maybe you'd have an equal protection claim, but some people do think the New York Times is a suspect class. Sorry, that's a little constitutional law joke.
Yeah, they love the suspect class jokes at the conservative media.
Law humor. But
they pee their pants on that one. It kills at the room.
So I'm not sure what the legal theory would be. It does strike me as some sort of problematic as a matter of the First Amendment to the extent that we need to protect the press's ability to report the news.
Really? So do you think the New York Times has a First Amendment claim? So in other words, who do they have to let in that room?
We just started talking about this like 15 minutes.
Yeah, we're just hearing.
So you don't have an instant legal theory?
No.
What do you think you're doing?
Just add water.
We're wondering out loud.
Yeah. Well, the fact of the matter is you usually don't need the courts to enforce this one. The media usually is pretty good at enforcing its own access because they can get... speaking from experience, they can get pretty...
Really? Nasty. What happened? Tell us.
I should have gone to lunch with you more often, Joni. If you don't... See? Did I tell you? There you go. You have it on the record. It really is as simple as that. Press that are denied access are going to make you pay. And I think we're already seeing that with Trump. The media that Trump's been getting is just terrible. And attempting to manage it by punishing certain outlets is not going to work for him in the long run. And who knows if he'll ever adjust or not, saying that the press is the enemy of the people and that, you know, the press is the opposition party that they're running against.
How well does this play with the American people who can't stand the media? Supposedly, I've heard.
It's going to play really well with Trump's base, but in the long run, it's not going to work for him because the press can hurt you in a lot of ways, not even on this topic. In fact, the best thing that the press could do is not get too wrapped around the axle of Trump's war on them and just simply keep reporting on all of the really bad stuff that Trump is doing. Mm. And that'll kill him, because the fact of the matter is the press can choose how hard they want to go, how consistently they want to hit those stories. And they're political actors, too. I understand that they want to be objective, but they're also people with feelings and viewpoints.
So you're calling on the media to be more biased.
Well, I think the media has been – I'm not calling on them to be biased. I think that they have been holding
– selectively enforcing
they have been
their
holding
reporting
Trump
staffs
accountable. And it's working, frankly. And if they pick that up more, it'll continue to work. And Trump is making a big mistake.
Well, yeah. I don't think they should get too wrapped up in their own response to this, because it's too much about them.
The media.
Yeah, about the media. You don't want to say, oh, and today he heard us again.
Yeah, that's what Mike is saying, right? Just report.
I agree. Just do your job and do not get sidetracked by this.
Okay.
Absolutely do not do that. The other thing that I've been wondering about all this attacking of the media is, why is he trying to limit the media's power so much? In other words, what does he know is coming about him that they need to be diminished? I find that, you know, more interesting than all of this in some ways. Like, he knows he's in trouble with something, maybe about Russia, and wants the media as low as it can be to present that when it comes out.
Prepare to mistrust the following Pulitzer Prize winning series about me.
Yeah, right.
Like that.
Yeah, right.
So the administration is, you know, testing that old rule of thumb that politics was followed, which is it's unwise to pick a fight with people who buy ink by the barrel. The problem is those aren't the people who dominate the news anymore. It's you know, I think Trump is testing this idea that he doesn't need the mainstream media, as the right likes to call it, because he can get directly to the people. So in other words, he's willing to pick a fight with the New York Times, with
CNN,
and with the broadcasters, because he can just go right around them. It's pretty interesting. It's also pretty dangerous. But he may have decided that they hate him anyway, and he hates them, so screw him.
You know who is in that room, or was today, that scheduled briefing? Breitbart was there. Not the New York Times, but Breitbart, the far-right website. And Breitbart's making news again this week because Milo Yiannopoulos has resigned as an editor there. He's a writer, a public speaker, and he mocks and belittles liberals and many minorities and vulnerable groups. And some college campuses wouldn't let him speak, partly because of raucous protesters. The University of Washington did let him speak here, and a man protesting outside got shot by one of Milo's supporters, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yiannopoulos has resigned at Breitbart after this video emerged of him apparently praising pedophilia.
Some of those relationships between younger boys and older men, the sort of coming-of-age relationships, the relationships in which those older men help those young boys to discover who they are and give them security and safety and provide them with love and
two participants objected that it sounded as though Yiannopoulos would have had no problem with the pedophilia that occurred in the Catholic Church.
And you know what? I'm grateful for Father Michael. I wouldn't...
Yiannopoulos said the same thing 10 months ago on another podcast. Matthew Schlapp, chairman of the annual Conservative Political Action Conference, canceled Yiannopoulos' speech and told Fox News he couldn't defend those remarks.
It certainly sounded to us
that he was trying to mainstream something as offensive as pedophilia. And we don't, although there are a lot of political disagreements that happen on the CPAC stage.
Yiannopoulos praised himself repeatedly at a press conference this afternoon, but said he made a poor choice of words.
It's NPR's David Folkenflik reporting. So we have watched the Milo story unspool close up, including in Seattle. Joni, what's the lesson here? What's the point?
Well, the lesson is, and this doesn't happen very often, is sometimes a world-class jerk gets his comeuppance. Karma doesn't normally work that directly and that quickly. But, you know, he had the worst week, I think. You don't like to do those worst week in Washington or worst week. We can nominate him for that. I will. I mean, you know, look, he got hit by the fact that people don't have an appetite for, they don't want a book by a guy who talks like that. They don't want him to speak at CPAC. I mean, geez, do you think that fits? No. And he had to leave Breitbart, which is now all of a sudden the media organization of the day. So, yeah.
What's the lesson, Mike McGinn?
I think the lesson is that the far right was okay when he was picking on immigrants, people of color, and women. But when he got to pedophilia, it was too much, even for them. But it really is revealing that he's getting a book contract. He was speaking at CPAC with all of the hateful and horrible things he was saying about Americans, you know, our neighbors, about women. And it's crazy. So this is what it took. You know, he rode his outrageousness and was hailed by conservatives and applauded by them and rewarded by them. And he just went too far. But let's go back to he should never have gotten that platform from them, given what he was saying about women and people of color and transgender individuals and all the rest. It's a real sign of, you know, just how terrible the right has become where that was accepted.
But all of that said, I do think that the UW president made the right decision to let him speak, even though it didn't turn out very pretty.
Jennifer Rubin of The Washington Post wrote a great column about CPAC's poor decision to invite this guy to speak to begin with.
This is the Conservative Political Action Conference,
which has been meeting this week in Washington, D.C. So a couple days ago, on the 21st of February, she published a pretty damning piece accusing CPAC of basically being intellectually bankrupt at this point for kind of grabbing, you know, onto the headlines that Milo's generates because of his very, very provocative and disturbing approach to a lot of issues. And I think that's really the larger story here is that, you know, this guy isn't a conservative in the way that most of us who are conservatives believe you should be. And why was he invited to speak? And good for them for disinviting him, although they should have done so earlier or not invited him to begin with.
Yiannopoulos says these are selectively edited videos. Quote, if it somehow comes across through my own sloppy phrasing or through deceptive editing that I meant any of the ugly things alleged, let me set the record straight. I am completely disgusted by the abuse of children. And by the way, this was not liberals bringing him down. It was a conservative blog called the Reagan Battalion that promoted that video on social media. CPAC disinvited him. The book publisher, Simon & Schuster, has canceled Milo's book deal. Whether we've heard the last of him, don't know. We'll see. Coming up on KOW's Week in Review, we have just enough time to squeeze in baseball, which is how it ought to be. We ought to just dispense with it as soon as possible, apparently. Playing first base, batting left, Joni Balter.
Oh, really?
Seattle Channel's,
really, really, really.
Yeah. Former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, former State Attorney General Rob McKenna in right field. Thanks for tuning in today on the Week in Review. Lastly, the problem with the Mariners is they spend too much time playing baseball. Major League Baseball wants to quicken up the game by eliminating the four-pitch intentional walk. This is where the pitcher, I'm going to keep this simple, the pitcher's decided to walk the batter on purpose. Since it takes four balls for a walk, you have to sit there and watch the pitcher throw four pitches, one after the other, to his catcher who's standing up out of the batter's reach. And when it's all over, the hitter finally trots down to first base, just like you knew was going to happen. The league says that slows down the game. Just have the pitcher make a signal and the batter goes to first. Is this modern, fast-paced fun or a desecration of our national pastime? Rob McKenna.
Blasphemy. Cry blasphemy, I say. I understand what MLB's doing here. They're trying to speed up the game. But, come on, really? This isn't right. As a number of people have pointed out on Twitter, sometimes when he's throwing the ball to the catcher who steps out of the box, he misses and something interesting happens.
Interesting like this.
There's the go-ahead run. Ramirez at second base. First base is open now. And line drive to center field. A base hit for Cabrera, who swung at that pitch. What a smart play by Cabrera. Williams didn't get it far enough outside, and Cabrera alertly swung at it.
It happens in Little League when you don't get the ball out. I've just never seen anybody walk anybody like that.
Now, I don't know if we're confusing non-baseball fans, but you get the idea that it's this pro forma thing, but sometimes somebody doesn't do it just right, and you get one of those weird, this week in baseball, top play. It's weird and interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think baseball is overly concerned about speeding up the game, but then I'm a traditionalist and I like spending 3 to 3.5 hours. It's one of the reasons I go to baseball center. It's like going fishing. You can just legitimately goof off. So I don't want them to shorten the games to 2 hours and 10 minutes.
There is that. And you know that the intentional walk, of course, was a fine restaurant at Safeco for quite some time, if you remember. But
W-O-K by any chance?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, indeed. And so there's many ways to speed up this game. How about TV timeout? How about catcher-pitcher conversations? How about a warm-up? How about the intentional walk of the non-restaurant variety? I mean, you can do it. Every now and again, you can have in a moment like you played, but not that often.
I'd like the pitchers to have to hit again. I enjoyed that. And by the way,
want to be a National League town?
Yeah, and I love Edgar, and I get that, the DH thing. But and by the way, as long as we're on this, I think the 3-point line in basketball is just an abomination. Just get rid of it. We need to get rid of it. That's absolutely wrong.
Go Sonics, I think, right?
Oh, they went, all right.
Come back, Sonics.
Ooh, still too soon, Rob.
Yeah,
still
too
soon.
It hurts me to say it.
If we sped the game up, how many losses could the Mariners fit in?
How many
not making the playoffs? We all know what's going to happen, right? So why can't we just get to the not making the playoffs at the beginning of the season?
I mean, that is an advantage.
It's cruel of you to say that. Remember, the Kansas City Royals, who were in the cellar for so many years, went to the World Series. You would have made a terrible Cubs fan, Bill. That's all
you
I can
really
say.
You really would have.
You got to have a heart. We should cue Damn Yankees right now. We don't have it. Okay, well, I thank you. For that matter, we could just, all of life, we could just, why walk your dog with a leash and a poop bag? Just doggy treadmill. We could speed up a lot of things if that's the goal of life. I'm with you, McKenna. Let's go to the park and hang out for 3.5 hours. What do you say? You and me, buddy.
Right on.
How's that sound? Right?
I'll buy the beer.
Okay. You have to buy a lot of beer.
I'll have to buy more beer because it's going to take a long time.
Well, thank you for listening. I hope your weekend is clipped and efficient and you don't have to endure 60 seconds of boredom if you don't want to. Rob McKenna used to be Attorney General, King County Council member, Boy Scout.
I still am.
Fellow Husky student when I was there.
That's right.
Mike McGinn, former mayor of Seattle. You going to run again?
Who knows?
Sounded like he was
manage your budget,
show.
Murray. Joni Balter, you were with the Seattle Times, and now you're with the Civic Cocktail Seattle Channel.
Yeah.
And who knows what you're going to do next?
You don't.
You might be.
You don't.
You might be shut out of a White House press briefing one of these days.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in and joining us on Twitter @KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us.